And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton and the surrounding municipality at 93.3 FM and the rest of the world on our online streaming service at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. We're very pleased to have with us today Glenn Ford. He is the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, a very important magazine, comes out of the United States, and Glenn has a distinguished background and is a very knowledgeable commentator. And I can tell you he's a veteran of more than 40 years in broadcast, print, and internet journalism, a former Washington bureau chief and White House, Capitol Hill, and State Department correspondent. Ford co-founded and hosted America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated black news interview program on commercial television, and he also launched and owned the radio syndications Black World Report, Black Agenda Reports, and Wrap It Up, the first national hip-hop radio music show. He has also worked as a radio newsman in Washington, Baltimore, and Atlanta, Columbus, and Augusta, Georgia, and produced over 1,000 radio and TV commercials. Glenn, we're very pleased to have you on the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Brendan.
Well, your articles from Black Agenda Report, those written by yourself, by Bruce Dixon, by others, they've been circulating here in Canada. As soon as the Libya war broke out, we were looking for voices and independent voices and commentary on what was happening because we knew the corporate media were feeding us a line and that the ability to get information out of Libya was very limited. But there were some people that were analyzing the information coming out, analyzing what President Obama was saying, analyzing the speeches of NATO and what the news reports were saying, and giving us some real news and some real investigation and some real coverage. And Black Agenda Report was at the forefront of that in the United States. When people were confused about what was happening, you could rely upon Black Agenda Report, just as you still can, for the leading commentary on these issues. And we've conducted 6, 7, 8, 9 interviews about the subject of Libya now on this radio program. This has been going on for more than 100 days, plus the lead-up to that conflict itself. And there's a lot of things we've seen, and some pretty outrageous things, but I guess what takes the cake now, at least for me, and people aren't discussing this, so I'm glad we have you with us today, and that is Hillary Clinton has warned Africa of a new colonialism. So you open the newspaper, and there was Hillary Clinton, her face on the picture, staring at us, saying, Africa, we have to warn you about colonialism. And she was referring specifically to China. But what do you think about that, particularly at this point in time, that Hillary Clinton could make a statement like that?
That's almost funny. I guess it's black humor, and I don't mean African-American, but very dark humor. You know, the United States was part of the Berlin Conference of the 1880s when various European powers divided up not just Africa, but the whole world into spheres of influence. That included the United States. So when the subject comes to the colonial powers, the United States is one of them and is now, of course, the superpower, the Big Daddy. I guess she's the Big Mama of Big Daddy. The Africans know what colonialism is all about. They've been under it for 500 years. And clearly, but when someone comes to you warning about, and I believe she was talking about the Chinese, when someone comes to you warning about some kind of new colonialism, you can bet that is the chief colonialist speaking.
Perhaps they see an upset to the existing order, a potential upset. Well, the United States has a lot of business going on in Africa in terms of how it wants to influence states and influence governments. And AFRICOM, for example, this African command structure for the United States, is something that has grown a lot in the last few years. You might have only seen a few mentions, say, 3, 4 years ago of AFRICOM and what it meant, but it's really been picking up because people anticipated activity by the United States, that it was gathering to do something. Now, AFRICOM is a very big word because the United States is involved in direct military operations against a country in Africa. So where do we see AFRICOM fitting into this picture? How long have you guys been following this, and when did it become a big item?
Well, it's been a big item for us for the last 5 years or so. AFRICOM grows by leaps and bounds because it's on the cutting edge of the U.S. policy of militarizing so many of the functions that were previously civilian in the world, mostly State Department, but many other agencies. In AFRICOM, which is the newest U.S. command, it's the cutting edge. It most thoroughly reflects the new policy of the United States, which is to militarize all of its dealings with the rest of the world. That includes disaster relief, if you remember the Pakistan earthquake, the Asian tsunami. The U.S. military was purposely and organizationally in the forefront of U.S. aid to those regions during the disaster. The United States' way of saying, if you want to accept our aid, you have to accept our military presence.
Exactly. When the United States discusses helping people nowadays, it's always got to come out of the back of a camouflaged airplane. Maybe it's a transport aircraft, maybe it's a bomber aircraft, but that's what they mean by aid now.
Yes, and that acclimates one to the United States' ultimate goal. You know, the United States is a world-occupying power like probably has never been seen since, as you mentioned, the British Empire. 700-and-something bases all over the world. They foist and push bases on anyone who's willing to speak to them. That's the first thing out of their mouths. So the aim is clearly to be an occupier of the world. And that's part and parcel of the transfer of previously civilian State Department and USAID functions now to the military that is most thorough, most advanced in the Africa Command. Also, AFRICOM has had more success, probably in a quicker space of time, in terms of, I guess there's no other way to term it, infiltrating and subverting nations. It really has been phenomenal. Last year, most of the nations of the African Union held joint military exercises with the United States. And those exercises revolved around the use of not only United States command and control equipment, but command and control procedures with United States advisors, command and control communications advisors, scattered all throughout all of these 50-something militaries holding these joint maneuvers.
Well,
understand what that means. That means that all of these countries are not only using U.S. equipment, but are using U.S. protocols and are being advised by U.S. personnel in the ways that they will command, move around, communicate with their own soldiers. This means that none of these countries is in a shape to resist the United States if the United States has any hostile intent towards any of these countries. The U.S. is actually running the guts of what makes a military. The U.S. has general-to-general, colonel-to-colonel, captain-to-captain relationships, and that is by design, so that every Cameroonian general has a kind of buddy AFRICOM.
Yes.
Among an American military general.
They did something similar in Latin America with the former Venezuelan military before Chavez and other countries, of course. The F-16s, of course, are from the United States, would be integrated with them. The training, the officers that would go to the School of the Americas and also train in the United States itself. And I guess now this is something that requires a lot of organization, and it's happening across Africa. So all these dozens of states, likewise, there's an attempt at integration then.
And understand what that means. That means that the U.S. military has a special relationship, a deep and detailed and personal one, with virtually all of the militaries of Africa. They can speak to any of those nations' militaries, disregarding the civilian or even military administration of that country. You know the ramifications of that. That means the United States has the potential to pull off a regime change without invading a single inch of space, almost at will, because of the relationships with these militaries.
Embrace and extend. You know, I had mentioned the British Empire before the program because that's the only thing you can seemingly compare the United States to. It's not just waging war on everyone. There's a special relationship going on here, and it goes to Obama's language and the way he's trying to define the current war on Libya, because we all know he's been trying to dodge that issue, saying it's not a war, so it was an overseas contingency operation or whatever, and now he says it's not really a war because the Libyan military could not resist, so United States forces have not been engaged in hostilities. I guess if the country is too militarily weak to resist the United States, and there's more than one country like that, you're not engaged in wars anymore. You're engaged in policing or reshaping the world or an extension of business and regular politics as occurs out of Washington.
Yeah, this is more than just a battle of euphemisms, and it is tempting to say that Obama has taken this to a higher level, that he is really outbushed Bush. But, you know, if you look back in history, it is not so strange. The Europeans, seldom, as they were expanding, conquering, sometimes exterminating whole peoples all over the planet for 500 years, I call it the 500-year war, but very seldom in these conquests did they describe what they were doing as wars, only if they suffered unacceptable casualties. So there were the Zulu Wars in South Africa, but most of the British and French suppressions of that continent don't have the word war attached to them because not enough, it didn't quite, well, first of all, they weren't conflicts between equals.
Well, it's not a war until they can fight back. And for the Europeans and the Americans, it's not a war until the Europeans and Americans start dying.
And so now, with the United States having achieved, or hopes that it has achieved, full-spectrum dominance, that means that wars can be waged, devastating to those who are targeted all over the world, without putting at significant risk United States personnel. And so we have arrived at a situation in which the United States chief executive could declare, even if there were 10 hostile actions, aggressions by the United States going on in the world, that none of them were wars because they were all either carried out by drones or the United States had such absolute air supremacy that the only casualties would be by mistake.
Well, there's your part of it is, that, I mean, that, I guess you could say it's part of the Obama doctrine. A lot of people have come up with nicknames for Obama from the left and from the right. I think, what about Drone Bomber? Drone Bomber, because he's using drones everywhere, and not only are you going to see that in Africa and the Middle East, but I'm sure one day those drones will come back to the United States and Americans
well,
will.
I do associate Obama with R2P, the responsibility to protect so-called humanitarian intervention. It predates him, of course, and you guys in Canada have a long history with it. The so-called philosophy behind R2P was evolved or devolved greatly with the occupation and almost nullification of the sovereignty of Haiti, of which Canada is very complicit. But I think that R2P will be associated as something of an Obama doctrine by history, because the American people did not believe in the humanitarianism of George Bush.
Yes, yes.
And so he could say humanitarian all he wanted, and a large portion of the American people was quite ready to believe that it was aggression, which of course it was. But Obama has so bamboozled the public, black and white, a public that is so anxious to be on the right side of history, even though the United States is uniformly on the wrong side, that the philosophy or doctrine of humanitarian intervention, I think, gains traction under him and becomes associated with him. And I'll give you an example. Last week, there was a vote on a pretty straightforward measure to defund the Libya war. And of the Congressional Black Caucus, 40 members, 21 voted against it, but 19 voted for it. So it's basically split in half, and almost every one of them will make defense of their vote on general grounds of humanitarian intervention that they would never have made, of course, with George Bush, even if he was had followed the same exact policies and said the same words.
Well, you know, perhaps only Obama could have invaded Africa. It would have been more politically difficult for George Bush to do so. It took Obama in the same way that you needed Tony Blair to dismantle social democracy in the United Kingdom. But Obama's had help on this because there's been people waiting in the wings of the Democratic Party, Samantha Power, Hillary Clinton. They're very big humanitarian interventionists, having helped develop that philosophy back in the 1990s.
And don't forget Susan Rice. She's right up there with Samantha Power. And Susan Rice is now the ambassador to the UN.
Absolutely. They're being given their chance to shine. This is their time in the sun to show what that ideology is all about, if we hadn't already learned in Haiti and elsewhere. And it's a huge problem, not just in the United States, but in Canada as well, because when it comes down to it, Canadians don't like military interventions. They don't like bombing people. They don't like occupying places and being involved in guerrilla war, civil war, and so forth. So what you have to tell Canadians is it's humanitarian. We're there to help the people. They can't handle themselves. And they need us to put boots on the ground and sort them out and make things right. And that's what we're told about Haiti. That's what we're being told about Libya. And in fact, if you see the parliamentary debate, everyone was saying, we support the responsibility to protect. We support humanitarian intervention, even more than you guys do. And therefore, we need to be there to help the Libyans. And the only way you can justify this, the way it becomes so prevalent, so easily spread, is because of beliefs about Africa. The Libya war was justified on the idea that there was all sorts of Africans in Libya that were raping people, and then that Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his troops so they could rape more efficiently. And it seemed that anything, you could say any lie about Libya without backing it up, and it would remain unchallenged and go back to our idea of helping those people.
Yeah, historical white supremacist biases are weapons of war when it comes to Africa. We also have to look at the racial situation in North Africa itself. It has become clear to us at Black Agenda Report that the so-called rebels are using Arab anti-black African racism as a motivational tool in their rebellion. They are constantly talking about the dangers from the blacks, and black rape, and black mercenaries. That obviously resonates among a segment of the Arab Libyan population. Even the Wall Street Journal had an article 2 weeks ago detailing how this town, about 25 miles south of Misrata, a town that is predominantly black because it used to be a center of the slave trade, it was a slave market town in Libya back in the days, and the population now reflects it. This town is under siege. Residents of this town who made up a large part of a neighborhood in Misrata were driven out, ethnic cleansed, and that this town is now being besieged by rebels who have painted signs along the road declaring their intention to purge black skin. Blatantly racist campaign. The rebels claimed that they were having trouble capturing the oil town of Brega because of the presence of a 5,000-man Chadian military unit. Even their imperialist backers, the United States and the French and the British, didn't go along with them on that because it was absolutely ridiculous. There are so many satellites in the sky looking at Libya, which has very few trees. Chad is more than 1,000 miles away. 5,000 men on the kind of scale of the fighting that's going on in Libya, which is very small units.
Well, Glenn,
a decisive amount of people, so it never existed, but this was being used for internal consumption by the rebels to scare the Libyan Arab people into being motivated in defense against the black peril. So this is going on as well within Libyan society.
Yes, and you mentioned propaganda for internal consumption. I was looking at the Twitter feeds from some Libyan rebels. Well, you have to love Twitter, of course. That has quite a history now in some of these things. So I was looking at the Twitter feeds from self-proclaimed Libyan rebels, and they said things like Gaddafi was going to unleash mustard gas. They said that for about 3 weeks, that he was going to unleash mustard gas in Benghazi and Misrata. There's lots of stories and allegations about rape and massacres, and the Chad Chadian army has been a major feature of these tweets. So the Twitter feeds say, we had an engagement on the border with Chadian forces. They're sending tanks and so on. All sorts of things that you surely would have heard about if these things actually happened. So there's quite some interesting stories coming from the rebel side there. And on that subject, of course, we've been detailing the many allegations coming from Al Jazeera, from the rebels and so on, about African mercenaries and about alleged crimes, a lot of which or all of which turned out to be manufactured. But of course, if you're talking about war crimes, we have plenty of evidence about racially motivated attacks by the rebel forces. And the way that international law or justice is being applied among the Westerners through the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And we've only seen one side of this, which is that they've accused Gaddafi of various crimes, calling him a criminal and saying that he should stand trial in the ICC. It was Luis Moreno Ocampo from the ICC who suggested that Gaddafi had been distributing Viagra to the troops about a month after that rumor had been discredited. So Gaddafi falls under this docket, but I don't believe the rebels are falling under this docket at all. And of course, the United States continues to bomb Libya and other countries under the ICC. So I guess the ICC pretty much fits in this system of AFRICOM and U.S. domination that you've already described earlier.
Yeah, the African Union was probably the only international body that was not consulted by the United States and France and Britain when they were planning their invasion and attack on Africa. One cannot overstate the disrespect, the arrogance, and how that is perceived among the African heads of state. Many, of course, of whom are quite malleable or even clients of these various powers, but who have been made to look in the eyes of their own people like diplomatic and political non-entities. So you have the situation in which the chairman of the African Union, Mr. Ping, advised all the members not to cooperate with the International Criminal Court because, he said, the criminal court has been discriminatory, because it only indicts Africans and never investigates Western crimes, and he was specific, Western crimes in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Now, those are the kind of words that we haven't heard from African leaders in generations. So we can see the depth of anger and slight and hurt that they feel.
Well, right now,
during this invasion and the disrespect that they've been afforded.
It seems to me the ICC is acting like a kind of mob. They want to go after Gaddafi, and then they have Bashir of Sudan. Of course, they'd like to see him in jail, rotting away in some UN gulag. Now,
that Moreno Ocampo guy has been proposing, pushing very vigorously for the ICC to, lack of a better term, to deputize the United States, which he says has the only forces with the kind of reach to enforce ICC warrants, to deputize the United States as a kind of policeman for the ICC. Understand, the United States is not even a signatory to the treaty that created the International Criminal Court. Either is China, either is Russia, and yet this Ocampo guy wants the United States to be the bully.
Well, I guess it's fortunate.
The armed cop of it.
Well, yes. Well, and there were people, I remember, 100 days ago calling for the United States and NATO to exercise a policeman role in Libya to help the rebels. So, you know, there is a belief, and there's a very Eurocentric belief, too, because I know a representative, I believe, of the ICC said that, and this is from Black Agenda Report, that this ICC representative said the whole world favors putting Bashir of Sudan.
Have mercy. The whole world. Here we have all of Africa almost unanimously, in fact, in terms of action, unanimously rejecting going after Bashir, acting on the ICC indictment of the Sudanese leader, as if Africa is not part of the world. At that point in time, Bashir was in China, and one-fifth out of every people in the world is Chinese, And this European has the gall to say the whole world wants Bashir arrested. I guess the whole world is made up of NATO.
Well, you know, maybe it is if you spend 90% of your time at, you know, wine and cheese functions in the Mediterranean or who knows what. That's your part of the Eurocentric view here. I guess
the U.S. is sometimes worse than that, more provincial than that. The United States talks about isolated countries, the countries that are isolated, that are only isolated by the United States. The United States for so long talked about the isolation of Cuba when nobody was trying to isolate Cuba in the world except the United States. So the U.S. probably has the worst of that Eurocentric disease.
Yes.
In that it can claim to be the world within these borders.
Well, you're talking about a country that, when it gets together with Canada...
Canada not included.
Well, no, Canada, we're so distinct that when the United States and Canada work together, they call it the international community. So when the U.S. and Canada go into Haiti and train soldiers and put the Duvalier elements back in charge, we're the international community helping Haiti. And, you know, who would disagree with that? International community building democracy in Afghanistan and so forth. So
I guess international community is all the nations that count.
Well, there's a very NATO perspective for you, and I guess we'll have to just finish on that note, thinking about NATO, because I mean, there's the question of the anti-war movement in the United States. We have an anti-war movement in Canada, and in many ways it has a lot of similarities to the U.S. anti-war movement. And certainly there was a change once Obama got in. A lot of people thought their work was done, but now we have more wars under Obama than you had under George Bush. So has there been a reaction to that? Is there organizing taking place now?
Yeah, there are efforts to organize, and of course we at Black Agenda Report are part of those efforts. But the air was knocked out of the chest of the progressive forces in general in the United States with the advent of Obama. I don't want to just limit it to the anti-war movement, because that doesn't really tell the story. You cannot have a progressive movement worthy of the name in the United States without an active black community. For the last 30, 40 years, I've periodically done my little calculations. The calculations are based upon different criteria over the years to try to figure out what portion of the U.S. population could reasonably be called progressive. Like I said, different criteria at different times. But it usually works out to around 20%. And half of that 20% or so is black. And when you have a black community that has been absolutely politically neutralized by the election of the first black president, then you just really don't have the critical mass for a real progressive movement, whether that be in terms of economic issues or anti-war or any of the other progressive arenas. And that is what has happened. This has really knocked progressives out of the box and made them irrelevant. They've made themselves irrelevant. They have opted out of struggle. This was the first election in which organized black America made not a single demand, not even the perennial demand for a Marshall Plan for the cities. Nothing. Nada.
So, I mean, I guess Obama becoming president was the big accomplishment, and that was that. That was the end.
Well, people pretended that it was the end. People made up an Obama, you know. It's not that Obama made promises that he didn't keep. It's that people actually conjured up their own personal Obama and invested him with their own aspirations. It then becomes very, very difficult to break with that person whom you have actually invented. I usually say that in terms of black folks, and this also applies to a lesser degree to white progressives, the conversation about Obama is not about what is he doing, that is some kind of examination of his policies, but how is he doing, that is, how is he faring in in his jousting with the Republicans. What are his chances? Not what our chances are, but what his chances are. And so I'm saying that to say that people are not even in anything that you could describe as close to a healthy political analytical mode. They're not even looking at the right directions. They're not. They're more concerned with his prospects than with their own. And several recent polls have shown, they've all had almost identical results, that black people who have fared far worse in the Great Recession and meltdown than any other major group in the country tell pollsters that they are more optimistic about the economy, about their own lives, and about black people's fortunes than any other group in the country. This is a kind of insanity, and it's what happens when something so outside of the American experience as the election of a nominally black person to the White House occurs.
Well, we know what the economic situation in the United States is, and certainly I guess some people are projecting Obama's like the big champion on a unicorn who's going to ride in there and do everything for them, and people don't have to be mobilized. It sounds like we have our work cut out for us, and certainly we're glad to have you today, because only a strong, healthy, independent journalism can bring a program like Black Agenda Report to Canada. Only by having radio stations that have these programs can we listen to Glenn Ford's excellent commentary. So I wanted to thank you for taking the time, because, you know, I've been reading your articles for quite some time now, and although this is the first time I've spoken with you on the program, it's like talking to an old friend, because, you know, you know the deal, you know the score, you knew what was happening in the Obama campaign as it was happening. You told people what Obama was going to do and how they should approach the issue, or how they might want to think about approaching the issue, and if only we had been listening more. We can still get excellent commentaries. Black Agenda Report is online. It's blackagendareport.com, so blackagendareport.com, so you can also get that straight out through Google. So you also have radio segments and some videos posted there as well.
Yeah, and we'll soon be doing a television show, although I hope I didn't jinx it by blurting it out.
Not to worry. Okay, well, Glenn, thanks so much.
We do all of this on air, that is, with nothing.
You mean you do it live?
No, I mean, we do it with no resources.
Oh, no resources. So you need a budget. Well, Black Agenda Report.
We just do it. We worry about budgets later.
Well, that's a true activist for you. See? Okay. Well, that's something we should be paying attention to. Everyone should go to Black Agenda Report. Check out what they're doing. See how you can be involved. This is some of the top-of-the-line coverage, and it's been there for a while. Now we can pick up on it. Glenn, again, it's welcome or wonderful having you here.
Oh, so nice to be in your presence. You guys are cutting edge in the CA.